has a series of events, very exciting events, but in terms of certain general lessons we can learn about the revolutionary process in general. I start with a number of propositions. I am really paraphrasing Trotsky's history. If someone says I'm not quoting him accurately, absolutely right, I am paraphrasing. The first proposition is that the most important feature of any real revolution is the direct interference of the masses in historical events. This is, of course, what distinguishes a revolution from a political coup, an army, or what have you. The direct intervention of the masses. The second is that this is a rather exceptional event. It is not the norm. Trotsky's formulation. Entirely exceptional circumstances and conditions, independent of the will of parties and individuals, are necessary in order to tear off the fetters of conservatism, not conservatism in the party sense, conservatism in the general sense of living your own life and so on, and to throw great masses into activity. That's a very important consideration to which we shall return. Finally, the dynamic of the revolutionary process is essentially a political, psychological one. Let me explain. According to historical materialism, to which I subscribe, Hail Mary and all the rest of it, there are changes in the base and the fundamental conditions of life for the mass of the population, in the techniques of production and therefore in the relations of production, and so on and so forth. All this is right. It does not apply at all to the actual process of a revolution. Indeed, the notion that, Trotsky puts it, the dynamic of revolutionary events, once precipitated, is directly determined by swift, intense, and passionate changes in the psychology of the masses. I will not inflict any more generalities on you, except two very, very briefly. One is the question of leadership. You know, Trotsky's famous analogy of, in his history, of the what drives the engine. If he was writing, of course, in our own times, he would not refer to steam engines, would he? Steam engines were then still relatively progressive. Yes, you know. Without the piston box and the piston, the energy of the masses is dissipated. But it is not the piston or the box that drives things forward, it is the steam. Therefore, the two sides of the process, on the one hand, the elementary mass involvement requiring highly exceptional conditions, on the other hand, its direction in particular ways, which requires an organization, a party. Now, actually, we should look at this as all generalizations rather critically. We look at the February Revolution. Nevertheless, I believe it is fundamentally important. The final point is, any real revolutionary crisis anywhere, anytime, is preceded by a crisis at the top. That is to say, amongst the rulers. Comrades may remember, and again I'm quoting freely because I haven't got the thing written out in front of me, you know, Lenin's three propositions, the first of which is, for a real revolution, that the ruling class can no longer go on in the old way. It is not sufficient, he says, that the masses don't want to go on in the old way. There must also be a crisis at the top. And this third one is the question of leadership game. Good, away with generalities. Precisely because any real revolution is a highly exceptional thing. I say highly exceptional. Highly exceptional in the 19th century, more frequent in the first half of our century, and much, much more frequent in the second half, thank God. There are far more of them. Every such event has certain peculiarities which have to be understood in terms of what has gone before. Therefore, I will look briefly at the peculiarities of the Tsarist regime. We can sum up the first one in one word. Backwardness. Backwardness. Here we have a major imperialist power. In the diplomatic terms of the time, one of the five great powers. If we look at it in more narrowly military terms, the one of the five great powers which actually has the biggest army. By far the biggest army, actually. To its navy didn't amount to much, but never mind. The biggest army. Therefore, on the formal scale of military diplomatic calculations, this is one of the most important great powers. On the other hand, we look at the reality under this and we see the following things. First, in terms of industrial development, incomparably more backward than Germany, incomparably more backward than Britain, incomparably more backward than the United States and even France and so on and so forth. Why does that matter? Well, it matters because actually in 1914 the Tsarist regime recklessly plunged itself into a major imperialist war. And a war, a major war, not some piddling operation, but a major war is a test of any society. In truth, the Tsarist regime entered the First World War economically, in terms of its capacity to produce, in terms of its capacity to turn out guns, to turn out ammunition, to maintain a transport system which would make these meaningful, much, much, much more backward than any of its opponents, or its allies for that matter. The only one of its opponents that approximates to this level of backwardness is the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and even that, to tell the truth, was several cuts of Tsarism. That's the first thing. Second thing, we look at it. No, before I go on, it is worth making the point, because I shall have to return to it in the second, and in particular the third talk, the October Revolution, the fantastic weakness of what we have learned from the NATO ideologists to call the infrastructure. The infrastructure, the basic requirements, not simply to produce, but as ships of production. I've got a single figure, which I steal with acknowledgement, without apology, from Trotsky. If I can find it. Yes, I can. European Russia, forget about the wilds of Siberia, forget about Central Asia, European Russia, the operative bit, that is to say, west of the Urals, had in 1913, less than half a kilometre of railway track per 200... No, it's more than that, isn't it? Yes, indeed. Per 1,000 square kilometres. That doesn't mean anything by itself. Compare it with the German figure, which is the most relevant one. The corresponding German figure to the Russian car is 11, rather more... The Russian less than a half, rather more than 11.5. Now, I know statistics can be very, very misleading, but that single statistic gives us a notion of the fundamental weakness of the regime. Let us now look at the classes. I'll start with the working class. Because although it is true that Russia was very backward industrially, it is also true that the industry that it possessed was not itself backward. Most of it was not itself backward. There had been an enormous economic development under Tsarism from the early 90s right up to the war, which had produced a hothouse atmosphere, partly sponsored and encouraged by the state, above all dominated by foreign capital, a very, very rapid economic development. Those of you, and I don't suppose there's very many here, but I can see one or two might be, who look at the writings of the American Cold War and post-Cold War ideologists, they point out, actually, the rate of industrial development in Russia between 1893 and 1913 equaled or surpassed that of the high Stalinist epoch. That's right. Actually, they're not telling lies. Of course, it's true. If you start from nothing, it is quite easy to achieve a spectacular percentage increase. The point is, however, that such industry as existed was at the world level of technique, more or less. Secondly, a substantial working class had been created. I'll look at this working class in three categories. There were, the reason I keep quoting 1913 is that that's the year of the last Tsarist census. In 1913, in round numbers, 3 million industrial workers proper. There were also about 2 million transport and support workers, you know, including tram drivers as well as the railways and so on. There were also, on the face of it, it ought to have been a very significant statistic, but politically it did not turn out to be significant, at least 5 million landless peasants, i.e. agricultural workers. We now look not simply at the formal statistical structure of the class, but at its relationships. The industrial working class was highly concentrated. A very, very interesting data in Trotsky's book on this question. Actually, in terms of concentration, that relatively small number of 3 million industrial workers was much, much more concentrated than the American, British, or even German ones. Actually, on the data, this is the Tsarist data, remember, from 1913, approximately 40% of the industrial working class was employed in enterprises of 1,000 workers or more. That is nearly double, not quite double, the British figure is 23%, but nearly double the corresponding figure for Britain, the pioneer industrial, bourgeois industrial nation. That's a concentration. Look, I'm not going to talk about the parties of the working class because I'll discuss them more extensively in the next talk. We look now at the bourgeoisie. Now then, the Russian bourgeoisie had a number of problems. The first problem it had was that it was relatively weak, both in relation to the state and above all in relation to the bourgeoisies of Britain, France, even Belgium and Sweden. 40% of Russian industry overall, speaking about industry for the moment, was foreign owned. The great bulk of the foreign ownership being British, French, Belgian, Swedish, some Germans. But that figure does not in any way reflect the real picture. Because if you look at the then growth sectors, the metal trades, engineering, metal processing, above all, electrical, so on and so forth, their foreign preponderance is overwhelming. Russian bourgeoisie's real strength was in textiles, leatherwork, and so on and so forth. Now, this is important. It is important because it means two things. First of all, they are weak relative to their historical forebears in other countries, but they are exceptionally weak in relation to their own working class, small as that is. And their political incapacity is related to that fact, not simply a matter of psychology. Okay? There was indeed a large petty bourgeoisie.
We've got problems. Urban petit bourgeoisie, I think. We've got problems with definition here. I'm going to cut through them and say, yes, I accept the extreme figures. But actually, there must have been something like 20 million or so urban petit bourgeois. As a class, as a group, this proved itself to be entirely incapable of independent initiative until February followed the line of the big bourgeoisie, itself very weak. Right? Then we have, come on, the great masses. On the 1913 census, four-fifths of the economically active part of the population, that's those who work, whether for themselves or for someone else, four-fifths were peasants. It's fantastic. 150 million of people. Four-fifths of them are peasants. All I want to say about them at this stage is this. No, two things. First, after 1905, the Tsarist regime attempted to broaden its basis. There was a man called Solyukin, very intelligent reactionary, who said in effect, you know, after the shock of the 1905 revolution, you want a stable regime, you must create a land-owning peasantry. It's rather like Thatcher and shareholders. Except that Solyukin, of course, was more realistic. I mean, I can own a few shares. I don't, actually, I assure you, but if I did, it wouldn't influence my attitude very much. But if I own my own land, so to say, in a society where four-fifths are engaged in agriculture, that's a very different thing. The Stolypin regimes, which had been aborted by the action at the top, nevertheless had produced a significant differentiation amongst the peasantry. I don't want to stress this at this point, except to say two things. One, it's true, but two, in spite of that, the peasantry as a whole, including its richest kulak elements, felt oppressed by the regime, was in reality oppressed by the regime. Now, the peasantry is very important. Not in Britain. We don't have one. You know why not? Because of the extreme ruthlessness of the British bourgeoisie after revolutions of the 17th century and late 17th and throughout the 18th century, the British peasantry was destroyed as a class as surely as Stalin ever destroyed the kulaks. No question about it. However, in Russia, the peasantry was still four-fifths of the population. Now, second point, this mass, if we are right in saying, you know, the centrally important thing about a real revolution is the intervention of the masses, taking part in actively in determining their own destiny, what does this mean in Russia? It means that the peasant masses are centrally important. You ask yourself, why did the 1905 revolution fail? The army was shaky initially. Oh, massive opposition, general strikes, and so on and so forth. Because at the end of the day, the regime could rely on the passivity of the mass of the peasantry, and not simply the peasantry in the abstract. Let us look at the military bureaucratic apparatus, and in particular its military side. The largest army, not only in Europe, but in the world. What is it recruited from? Peasant conscripts. Without a break from that, without a break in that, no revolution in Russia is possible. Engels, many years before, not thinking about Russia at all, but about Germany, wrote in 1851, part of his correspondence with Marx, I have written down, so I'll give you an accurate quotation for one, said, "The fact is evident that a disorganized army and a complete breakdown of discipline has been the condition as well as the result of every victorious revolution." And he was not wrong. in 1905, at the end of the day, the revolution was beaten because the mass of the army, 4/5 of it, recruited, universal conscription from the peasantry, stayed with the regime. Finally, comrades, I want to say a few words about the ruling class. You know, it was exceedingly narrow. Because backward, but at the same time developing a contradictory country, had not earlier been able to rid itself of a narrow autocracy. It found itself by 1913-1914 in the hands of incompetence. I'll quote one of the examples later on. But the fact is, not only was the working class totally excluded from power, the bourgeoisie was excluded from power. Not only was the bourgeoisie excluded from power, the bulk of the big landowners were too. The regime had come to rest on a very narrow circle of personal favourites, bureaucrats, and so on and so forth, plus its military police apparatus, which looked very solid. But it had no serious political support, as was to be proved in a very spectacular fashion very soon. Final point I must make, before I go on to the process of the revolution itself, is the national question. Now, I will say, I mean, maybe people will disagree with this, the national question in Britain has some significance in relation to the six counties in Northern Ireland, but it is not really central to British politics. It's not really central. You can say this is a terrible thing, and it's all. It is a fact. The country, in spite of Scott Nats and Welsh Nats and so on, is relatively homogeneous. That was not true of the Tsarist Empire, which, remember, was not occupying the boundaries of today, but rather wider boundaries. Fact is, only 43% of the population, Tsarist censorship, census of 1913, only 43% of the population were Great Russians, determined linguistically, right? Most of them are literate. That means 50